The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
We're fortunate to have Sean Flynn with us today. He's the Associate Director of the Program on Information, Justice, and Intellectual Property here at the Washington College of Law. His research examines legal frameworks promoting access to essential goods and services, and he serves as counsel for advocacy organizations in state legislatures seeking to promote and defend regulations that promote access to essential medicines. Prior to coming to the program, Professor Flynn completed clerkships with the Chief Justice on the South African Constitutional Court and with the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. He also represented consumers and the government as a senior associate with Spiegel & McDermott and as a senior attorney for the Consumer Project on Technology, where he served on the policy team advising the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights. He's also taught constitutional law at the University of Witwatersrand in South Africa, and we're very lucky to have him here today. So with that, go ahead.
Great. Thank you very much. So this is a pretty cozy audience, and I'm the only one left. So I'll feel free to be a bit informal in my presentation, and feel free to kind of interrupt me as we go along. How many of you know what PIJIP is, the Program on Information, Justice, and Intellectual Property? Have any? So that's the program I run. It's the IP program here at WCL, but we do research and advocacy projects. A lot of them are grant funded, and one of our major project areas is on pharmaceutical policy. The link with intellectual property, of course, is that a lot of the problems caused in the pharmaceutical industry, be it marketing, excesses, excessive pricing, etc., have their underlying root cause in a monopoly granted by the patent system. So we look at the problems that those patents cause in the pharmaceutical industry and in other areas, and examine potential public policy solutions both in the U.S. and internationally. The issue I want to talk to within the theme of this conference on disparities is the North-South, or developing country disparities in access to medicines, and the link between those disparities and the globalization of patents with the World Trade Organization. Looks like maybe we have another panelist or two. So I'm going to talk a bit about what we call the Access to Medicines Movement, which is an international movement around access to medicine issues that deals in intellectual property issues, problems, and other kinds of policy solutions. And the links between intellectual property, trade policy, and access to medicines globally, and the North-South divides. And then some of the traces back to problems in economics and policy that come out of that. So the basic problem that the access to medicine movement arises to help try to solve is something like this. So medicines, as you know, can be very expensive, but they don't have to be expensive. Actually, making medicines is often incredibly cheap. The actual process of putting together a medicine and creating a pill is often very inexpensive. The amount of active pharmaceutical ingredients and the individual dose of a pill is often very, very small. The cost of making those chemicals is often tiny. What costs a lot is the research and development that goes into the initial invention of that drug. So we construct intellectual property policy as a means to try to create incentives to create those medicines in the first place. Because without some kind of means of being compensated for the invention, there would be no incentive to create new medicines. Because the costs of producing medicines are so small, competition would arise to keep those prices very low, and there would be no ability to recoup that investment cost on the front side. So patents cause problems on the flip side of that, right? So we create monopolies that allow manufacturers to price up to the ability and willingness of people to pay for a product, which in the case of medicines may be very, very high as an incentive for research and development, but those prices themselves cause access problems. People then can't afford those medicines, governments can't afford them, and in developing countries, often people are paying out of pocket for those medicines and literally cannot get access to those very medicines they need to survive. So patents on any kind of a product cause problems in the same way, raises prices and therefore reduces consumption of that good. But patents on medicines can cause particular problems for two reasons. One is that medicines, almost by definition, the patent covers the entire medicine, as opposed to some kind of widget that you might put into a machine that's part of a larger product. In the medicine context, the patent causes a nearly complete monopoly. And if it's a true innovative medicine that people need to survive, then that monopoly becomes particularly invidious, similar to monopolies, for instance, on the extension of water, electricity, other basic goods to your household. There's a strong government social need to control prices somehow on those medicines. Otherwise, the prices can get extremely exorbitant. There's lots of examples that we often know about. I mean, there's cancer drugs today that are priced in the U.S. at over $100,000 a year. AIDS medications in the late 1990s were priced at over $12,000 a year for products that we now know cost about $80 a year to make. So that difference between $80 and $12,000 is the patent premium. That's the additional amount that we are paying for each individual patient in order to create that incentive for research and development. Now, in large part because of recognition of this fact, that the fact that patents on medicines can cause particular harms and that they're very hard to control, patent policy in many countries has created specific exemptions for pharmaceuticals, specific tailored policy tools to address these kind of problems. So in Brazil, Argentina, Switzerland, and Japan, all until the 1970s or later, exempted pharmaceuticals entirely from their patent laws. In the UK and Canada, there were special compulsory licensing provisions for pharmaceuticals that allowed governments to open up access to generic competition specifically for pharmaceutical products. In India, they created a patent regime that only protected the process of making pharmaceuticals instead of the end product, which spawned the largest generic pharmaceutical industry in the world that grew up to reverse engineer around process patents and create competing products in the Indian market. And many developing countries until 1994 lacked patents altogether in any part of their economy. So in the 1970s and 80s, the pharmaceutical industry, largely based in the US and Europe, led a policy drive to change this state of affairs and globalize patent laws, specifically on pharmaceutical products around the world. And the idea was that there was free riding going on, that only the US and other rich countries were paying the large share of the incentive of the costs for those added research and development incentives, and that other countries were free riding on that invention. And ultimately, that policy process led to the inclusion in the 1994 World Trade Organization Agreement of a specific agreement on intellectual property. We call it TRIPS. It's the Agreement on Trade-Related Aspects of Intellectual Property Rights. And that set, for the first time in an international agreement, global minimum standards for intellectual property. All countries are now required to grant patents on products and processes. So that excluded the Indian example of only granting patents on processes. In all fields of technology, so that excluded the practice of, for instance, India or Switzerland, which excluded pharmaceuticals from their patent system. And so we can pause and kind of ask if that is a good thing. And in the abstract, there are definitely good aspects of the globalization of intellectual property. It did address a real free riding problem. That new medicines are are what economists call a global public good. I mean, a new invention, everyone benefits from it, whether you pay for it or not. So if only one country pays for the invention of a good, then all countries in the world still benefit from the invention of that new medicine. So we might think that there is a need for a global norm to create incentives to create those new medicines. And I would agree with that as a as an abstract principle. But my own position, which I want to talk a bit more about that today, is that the vehicle for creating those incentives of trying to basically internationalize a one-size-fits-all intellectual property system is a bad way to reach that good goal. And the reason is the topic of this conference, that it creates enlarged disparities between the rich and the poor around their ability to access medicines. And the reason for that is the particular economics, development economics, or the economics of developing countries, that explains how you can predict what prices will become under a monopoly regime. So that's a couple of these slides that, that I want to go over, explain that. So so this first slide is basically a very simplified economic model of what happens when you have a monopoly in a particular market. Now, this demand curve assumes that the cost of producing whatever that item is zero. So it just removes the cost of production from the equation to make it very simple to go over. And so if you are in a competitive market, this structure of a market would produce a price at zero. If any producer priced their good at higher than zero, perfect competition would bring in other suppliers that would undercut that item, and the market forces would continually push the price down to essentially zero, as small above zero as you can possibly get. But when you create a monopoly in that market, then the restraint on pricing is no longer the cost of whatever it is that makes the good. So in a competitive market, it's the cost of bringing that good to market that is the restraint on pricing. If a firm prices higher than cost, then other competitors will force that price down. They will come onto the market at a lower price, and the higher price competitor will fall out of the market. Everybody will buy the lower price good. But in a competitive market where you're the only supplier, then the restraint on pricing is not a function of cost or competition. It's just a function of the demand in the market. It's a function of people's willingness and ability to pay. So people will continue purchasing that good at a higher and higher price until either they don't want to, they switch to a substitute good, for instance, or in the case of a basic life necessity like medicines, until they literally can't. So if you think about, for instance, what you would be willing to pay for access to a life-saving AIDS treatment if you had AIDS, you can just go through the numbers in your head. At some point, you would no longer be able to afford housing and transportation to your job, etc. But until you got to that point, you would probably be willing to pay more and more and more. So the idea is that the ultimate restraint is a function of the demand curve rather than the cost curve. And a firm will continue raising that price until the price increase will cut the number of people purchasing the drug so much that their profits will actually fall. So monopolies don't raise their prices infinitely. They keep raising the prices until actually so many people fall off, either can't or won't purchase that product, that the additional price increase and the resulting reduction of people who buy the medicines will cut into their profits. And so what we call deadweight loss is the number of people who would have bought the item at a lower price, but don't buy the item at a higher price. And that deadweight loss column is the access problem. So those are people which at the higher price can't afford the medicine. And they literally do not consume the medicine that they would have at a lower price. And in this curve, which is just a fairly straight line curve, the profit maximizing price would be about here. This number of people would be sacrificed in the market. This is the new excess profits that go to the consumer. That's the research and development incentive. And so in this simple graph, about 50% of the market is excluded, 50% of the market still has the drug, and that creates new profits for the company. The key for thinking about north-south disparities is that the shape of that demand curve and how that demand curve will affect pricing differs depending on equality of income within the particular country. So if you take Norway, for example, the most equal country in the world, and you just look at distribution of income within, and you assume that ability to pay is going to be a function, is the demand curve will be a function of ability to pay, then that curve is fairly flat, right? So each time that you decrease the price on this demand curve, you pick up many more consumers. And that creates an incentive for the profit maximizer, for the monopoly, to continue decreasing the price in order to pick up more and more of the population. So in this market, for instance, you can assume that the monopoly holder would not price just to the top 10% of the market because they make more money by serving the next 10%, and more money by serving the next 10%, and more money by serving the next 10%. So each time they lower their price, they actually make more money because more people buy the drug at the lowered price until they get up to about 80% of the economy. So if you remember that first graph, I said that, you know, under this assumption, about 50% of the market was excluded. Under the Norway example, only about 20% of the market is excluded. But then if you start comparing that to some of the most unequal economies in the world, the result is extremely different. So here's a graph for South Africa's income distribution. You have the top 10% of the people in South Africa essentially earn first world incomes. The top 10% is a higher median income at this point, this is an old graph, than the United States. So you have the top 10% of people in South Africa are essentially living on above average US incomes. But then as you drop to the second decile, the number goes way down. So these people are living on less than $10,000 a year. And very quickly you get to a flat line at the bottom where many, many, many people are living at global standards of poverty line, less than $500 an entire year, for instance. And that creates very different pricing incentives for the company. So this is just translating that into a demand curve. So what you get, as opposed to the very flat demand curve in Norway, is you get an extremely steep demand curve at one side, representing the wealthy part of the population, and then a low, flat demand curve way at the bottom. We call this sometimes a hockey stick demand curve. And so if you can imagine, if this demand curve were vertical, that means that any time you raise the price, consumers would continue buying the same amount that they would before. So if a demand curve is vertical, there is no restraint on the monopolist. We actually had some examples of this. If you remember the Enron days in electricity markets, there's flaws in electricity markets because there's duties of electricity companies to supply electricity to consumers, and they had to buy those on auction markets, and suppliers would bid prices into the markets, but the consumers, through utilities, would only bid demand amounts, not prices, because they weren't allowed to not supply electricity. So on those very hot days, in those summers of 1996, when it got extraordinarily hot, which meant that there was so much electricity being used that there were very few suppliers left to bid into the markets, the Enron people knew that, and they knew that they could now infinitely bid. So units of electricity that used to cost $35 per kilowatt hour went up to $10,000 per kilowatt hour, and they could have continued to raise further. It became essentially a vertical market. There was no price restraint in the demand side. And so when you look at this, what you see is an extremely close to vertical market. These people up here will continue paying much, much more, a very high amount, and almost infinitely more compared to these people down here. So what does that do to the profit maximizing actions of the company with a monopoly? Well, in this market, if you sell at what the top people can afford, you make a very high amount, but every time you decrease the price in order to sell more units of the good, you lose money. So you lose money decreasing to what the second decile can afford. You lose money every time you decrease the price and pick up more consumers. So the idea that may seem intuitive, that drug companies under this new situation would lower prices in poor countries in order to sell more of the good, is actually wrong. Because the problem is there's too much inequality of income within poor countries. That most developing countries have a very small sliver of the population that lives essentially on first world incomes, and a large part of the population that's too poor to afford those same prices. And so the incentives that's created is to price essentially the same everywhere in the world, which is what happened in the period immediately after the 1994 TRIPS agreement. What you found, for instance, with AIDS drug suppliers is that those companies were pricing at the same level in every country. That $10,000 to $12,000 figure that I mentioned in the early part of my talk was the same price in South Africa as Norway, as the United States. Because of the economics lesson that we went through, it was actually rational for the companies to charge the same price everywhere. Because they're not serving the entire market everywhere. They would lose profits to do that. So what they want to serve is the rich countries and then all the people who have incomes like rich countries everywhere in the world. They're increasing their profits, but they're not increasing their service to the entire population. And that's basically the problem that spawns the access to medicines movement, that reacts to this with arguments that we can't have this state of affairs continuing to be globalized. That poor countries, in their implementation of the World Trade Organization agreements on intellectual property, need to implement very different kinds of laws than we have in the United States. That they need to use, for instance, compulsory licensing solution, forcing patent holders to license generic competition much more routinely than countries in the North. And that's basically where the debate is right now. Because of time, I'm basically going to stop there. Some of the questions that leaves is, if you get to this point, then how are we going to address the public good problem I mentioned? How do you create research and development incentives where everybody in the world buy in if this isn't the right way to do it, if patents aren't the right vehicle to do it? And that's one of the debates that's going on now. So thank you.
Well, as you can see, our panel has grown the last few minutes, which is wonderful. We're happy to have our additional guests. We're going to switch it up, despite the order that you see up here, and ask that Mr. Green speak next. Mark Green is the Managing Director of Malaria No More and comes to us after being a recent U.S. ambassador to Tanzania. He has a long record of public service and before his current focus on eradicating malaria. He's been a four-term congressman from Wisconsin and an active member of the House International Relations Committee Subcommittees for Africa and Human Rights. Mr. Green was also a crafter of the U.S. Leadership Against HIV/AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria Act of 2003. He's traveled to West Africa with international organizations like Oxfam, Save the Children, and the Academy for Educational Development, and we are grateful for his time and perspective.
Thank you. I apologize again. I didn't intend to make a theatrical entrance before. We had some traffic problems in getting here, but I am delighted to be here. I guess what I'd like to do is frame my comments around a story, a true story. About a month ago, I had the chance to visit a small hospital on the islands of Zanzibar that's called Nazi Moja. And literally translated, that means one coconut tree. And the story goes that there was a terrible cyclone that swept over the islands of Zanzibar and wiped out all the trees but one, a single coconut tree, and that's where they built the hospital. But what's really interesting about Mazia Moja is not the story of how people survived a terrible storm. What I think is especially interesting is how people are surviving the storm of global health challenges each and every day on the islands of Zanzibar, as typified by that hospital. On the day that I was there, and this is again just a month ago, our guide was Dr. Mohammed Jadawi, who was an old friend of mine from my days as ambassador. He's the principal secretary of the Ministry of Health and the licensed surgeon himself. And he took us upstairs at Mnazi Moja to the pediatrics ward. And as we were walking in, I saw that there were about 15 beds there. Dr. Jadawi said to us that just 3-4 years ago, there would be 3 children for every single bed in that pediatrics ward. But on the day that we walked in, there were 3 children in the entire ward. The first child was a child that had what Dr. Jadawi called clinical malaria, in other words, symptomatic but not confirmed by a test. The second child was a truly pathetic sight. The young child was largely listless, sickly thin arms, the cheeks were drawn, eyes were open, but unseeing. And Muhammad told us that the child's eyes had been damaged by vitamin A deficiency. And the third child that we saw was an even more heartrending sight. Her skin was so badly disfigured that as we were walking up to her, she looked like a burn victim. And that's what I began to say, and Dr. Jadawi said, no, that's severe malnutrition, protein deficiency. But he looked at her and looked at me and said, we can help her. Now, I tell you that story because, for me, it drives home several important lessons about health disparities and the global health challenges and opportunities that are out there these days. The first lesson, and it's one that's important for us to remember, is that historic progress is being made right now on a number of global health fronts. As Mohammed Jadawi said that day, not so long ago, there would have been 3 children to a bed, 45 in that ward, not 3. The good news is that because of a focused scale-up on proven interventions and, quite frankly, some of the medicines that we just heard talked about, we have an opportunity in front of us to conquer some of the diseases that were once believed to be inevitable. You know, if you spend any time in Africa, you'll meet person after person who will say, I am the oldest. I was the third born, or I was the fourth born, because his brothers and sisters had died before him in childbirth. But in malaria in particular, we're making extraordinary progress. On those islands of Zanzibar, just a few years ago, it was 40% infection with malaria. Right now it's below 0.5%. They actually believe that by 2015 they will eliminate entirely malaria from the islands of Zanzibar. In the area of neglected tropical diseases, lymphatic filariasis, or elephantiasis as it's known, there are now elimination programs for this terrible disease in 44 of the 83 endemic countries. River blindness, it's already been eliminated from 10 West African countries, and there are plans to do so in many other countries on the continent. So we should feel first good about the progress that's been made and the opportunities that lie ahead. Secondly, the progress that we're making on diseases like malaria and river blindness and some of the neglected tropical diseases, they free up for us resources to take on some other global health challenges. There's the obvious. In my Zanzibar story, the drop from 45 patients to 3 patients means that there are more than 40 children free of the disease, not in those beds, free to help their parents or play ball in the streets, or hopefully learning in school. But more realistically, what it means is that there are more beds available, hopefully more healthcare workers available, to take on the many other healthcare challenges that are out there. Like that boy with the damaged eyes, or that girl with a severe protein deficiency. The third lesson is one that has really struck me in recent weeks as we've been talking about malaria no more, about how we describe the challenges that are out there in malaria. And you know, I think we have to be careful when we talk about global health and global health challenges, not to look at those challenges through American eyes, which we often do when we talk about numbers. You know, in most places in America, a child is generally either sick or they're healthy. Of course, that's not the way it is in so much of the world, in the impoverished nations of the world. Children are never quite healthy in those countries. Maybe they manifest or they don't, but they're hardly entirely healthy. If a child is struck by malaria, for example, in his earliest days of life and survives, he will very likely suffer lifelong disabilities, cognitive disabilities, profound disabilities. Or he may just be weakened and vulnerable to other diseases and illnesses. And of course, he or she is already likely to suffer from poor nutrition, bad water, etc. So the child may not be down with malaria in the sense of being in a hospital bed, but neither is he strong and ready to learn. My first night as a volunteer teacher in East Africa, Kenya, some 20 years ago, my headmaster took me to a funeral. I went to the funeral of one-year-old twin boys who had died of measles. And when I said to him, "Thomas, you don't die of measles," he said, "Well, here you do." He said, "They didn't really die of measles. Measles pushed them over the edge. But they had malaria, and they had poor nutrition, and they had probably other diseases and parasites and health challenges that are out there." So when we talk about global health and how we combat the global health challenges that are out there, I think it is important that we realize that it isn't so black and white as we tend to talk about it here. I think that's one of the reasons why you're seeing President Obama's administration, unveil its recent Global Health Initiative. The Global Health Initiative is designed to build upon the marvelous programs that are already there, PEPFAR, the President's Malaria Initiative, and some other programs, and try to look for ways to integrate the services that are provided in some of those programs so that we get stronger health systems to begin with, and we have greater access to health care in some of those countries. And Malaria No More, we think it's a good idea. And we think that there are definitely some areas, particularly in the areas of diagnostics and lab facilities, where we can look for integration to strengthen the systems, recognizing that, again, when we talk about the health, particularly of infants and in women, pregnant women in particular, who are most vulnerable in places like Africa, we can't just look at it in black and white terms and through American eyes. It seems to me that we're living during pretty exciting times on the global health front. Again, we're now working on challenges and taking on global health challenges that seemed inevitable. I couldn't help but note as I was getting ready to come here today, the story that broke yesterday that, in fact, King Tut died of malaria. And of course, when they examined and did the DNA testing and took a look at the mummy, when they said he died of malaria, well, it's true, but of course there were a number of afflictions. Malaria was one of those afflictions. And so again, when you take a look at those challenges, you realize A, they've been with us a long, long time, and B, when we truly take them on, we can't just think in black and white terms, but have to realize that we need to work to strengthen the system as much as take on individual challenges. We can't back down from challenges like malaria and HIV, and obviously we as an organization are devoted to eliminating malaria and malaria deaths, but we also have to think about ways that we can take those programs and stretch them and expand them to help take on other causes, and that's what we try to do. Thanks.
Thank you. Next we have our own Professor Margaret Farrell. She attended the University of Chicago and Yale University's law schools and has also been a postdoctoral fellow at Johns Hopkins University School of Public Health, where she researched scientific evidence and expert testimony. She's published articles on a wide range of topics, from health care insurance to the use of special masters. She practiced law as a partner at the Washington, D.C. firm of Ennis, Friedman, Bersoff & Ewing, worked as a member of the Governance and Legal Audit Committee of the White House Healthcare Task Force, advising on ERISA and consumer remedies. She's currently a special master for class action fraud on behalf of mentally disabled residents in the District of Columbia's U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia. And she's also taught as a Fulbright lecturer in law at Fudan University in China. She studied public health in Cuba and has served as a volunteer legal advisor to the Minister of Health and Social Welfare in Liberia last summer. We are very lucky to have her as an adjunct professor here at the Washington College of Law, and to be able to give her the last word, at least for today, on global public health disparities. Thank you.
Thank you. It's good to have this opportunity to reflect on a trip that I recently took to Cuba. It was a 10-day trip that I took with 27 other healthcare professionals. I counted myself as a healthcare professional because I'm a lawyer that works in healthcare, that's professional. But all the rest were doctors, nutritionists, social workers, psychiatrists, mental health workers, and so on. And we had a very packed itinerary of visiting healthcare facilities and hospitals and sanitariums, and an opportunity to talk with all of the people that were involved in those institutions while we were there. When considering talking about this topic of healthcare disparities in Cuba, it brought to mind the question of whether the topic meant to include disparities within Cuba. Were we talking about disparities in access to care, or we were talking about disparities in terms of outcomes of care, or quality of care? And were we talking about disparities within Cuba, among Cubans, rich, poor, urban, rural, minorities, those kinds of disparities? Or did the topic also include disparities between Cuban citizens receiving care in Cuba and foreign visitors receiving care in Cuba in what's called medical tourism, which Cuba is trying to develop? And thirdly, I thought maybe the topic also included disparities between Cuba and other countries in the world as far as healthcare is concerned. So these thoughts encompass all of those aspects of healthcare in Cuba. Healthcare is regarded in Cuba as part of public health. They don't delineate it as we do as far as legal disciplines are concerned, in healthcare delivery and then public health. They see it all as one effort to improve the health of the community. Let me just tell you a little bit about Cuba and the environment that helps to shape their healthcare system. Cuba is an island that's about the size of Pennsylvania. It has 11 million people. Most of them do live in urban settings. Its population is made up of largely of people of European descent, but also mixed races, and it's about 10% immigrants long ago from Haiti who were African slaves. So it has a mixed population. It's the major language is Spanish. Its major exports are raw materials, nickel largely, sugar, tobacco, shellfish, coffee, and interestingly, doctors. I'll say more about that in a moment. It's a communist country. It was taken over by Fidel Castro in 1959 from a U.S.-supported, often characterized as dictator, Batista. And the healthcare situation at the time that the revolution occurred was that there were a fair number of doctors per capita in the population, but the disparities were great. The statistics that I was able to find indicated that about 82% of the rural population had no access to doctors, so that the doctors were located largely in cities, and they had private practices. And when Batista was overthrown, half of them left. There were 6,000 in the country at the time. Half of them left, many to Miami, but other countries as well. And so the Castro Revolution was left with essentially no healthcare system. And so they had to develop it. And they developed it in isolation. It is an island. It's politically isolated, certainly by the United States, and economically isolated by virtue of the U.S. embargo. Not totally. The U.S. embargo gets blamed for probably more of Cuba's economic problems than it should. But it did significantly isolate them. And so it was, Cuba can be almost seen as a petri dish experiment. And, you know, so how do you raise a healthcare system in this petri dish? And how did they do it? Well, the first thing they did was to establish medical schools. And the professors had left, most of them, too. So they established the medical schools using them as faculty, students who had just graduated from medical school, had very little experience. But they were of the revolutionary mind and went ahead and they began to develop faculties. Eventually those faculties grew and they were able to get foreign doctors to come and teach in those medical schools. But they developed a system where they have a medical school in each province. And then they subsequently developed a huge medical school, the Latin American Medical School in Havana, just outside of Havana, that it currently has 8,000 students. And it's a six-year program. It has students from all over Latin America, and they train them in Western medicine, but also in a way of delivering medicine that I will talk to you about in just a moment, of what, how their healthcare delivery system actually has been set up. So that was one of the first things they did. And then they established a three-tiered system for delivering healthcare. At the bottom level, they have family doctors, neighborhood doctors. There are catchment areas, neighborhoods, geographic neighborhoods, designed for one clinic in that area. The clinic is staffed with a doctor and a nurse. And they at least the doctor lives upstairs of the clinic. So they're really in the neighborhood. And their day is largely in the mornings. They said they see patients. And whether those patients make appointments to come in the morning, I'm doubting. I think they just come when they want to see a doctor. But in the afternoon, they go out and visit families. Families are much more the basic unit of healthcare delivery in Cuba than we are used to. We don't think of healthcare being delivered to individuals, but they really do see it as a family practice, which is not an unknown idea in this country either, but but they really do focus on the family. So they go out and visit each family at least once a year to assess the health care needs of those people. And they use this tripartite diagnosis, which is looking at their physical health, their mental health, and their social health, and look at how well are they functioning in their families and in their communities and for themselves. It's that basic focus on community and social functioning that makes it very different, I think, from the approach that we're taking, that our country takes. The statistics and the outcome of this system, you could say, is indicated by the statistics, that the health statistics of this population that is so certain. But I think you need to realize, as you pointed out, good health is a function of a number of different factors, not just health care, nutrition and the absence of disease and so on. So that they should be put in perspective in that way, but they are truly impressive. The life expectancy in Cuba is a little bit higher than it is in the United States. Mortality of children under 5 is 6.5 per thousand in Cuba and 7.6 in the United States. In 2009, infant mortality in Cuba was 5 per thousand, 6 per thousand in the U.S. Cuba has one doctor for every 170 people. In the U.S., we have one doctor for every 188. The World Health Organization calculates Cuba's annual per capita health expenditure at $229 and more than 6,000 per capita in the United States. So there's just a vast difference in the amount of resources that go into this system. It also has the lowest incidence and prevalence of HIV/AIDS of any country in Latin America, and comes off very well in world statistics on that score as well. So you can see, you know, how do they achieve those outcomes with this neighborhood system? Well, part of it is that the state does assume responsibility for providing for the health of the population. The Cuban constitution, I mean, unlike our constitution, was amended in 1976 to say that everyone has a right to health protection and care. The state guarantees this right by providing free medical and hospital care by means of the installation of rural and medical service networks, polyclinics, hospitals, preventive and specialized treatment centers, and by providing free dental care, promoting health publicity campaigns, health education, regular medical exams, general vaccinations, and other measures to prevent outbreaks. The key part of this, well, two key parts. One is that it does establish a human right and a positive right of its citizens and a correlating obligation of the state to provide medical care and treatment. But it also concentrates on prevention. The way they can make $269 per capita work to prevent, establish these very favorable health outcomes is with a great emphasis on prevention. And the doctors in these neighborhood clinics are activists. They go out and they talk to the schools, and they engage in campaigns to get everybody vaccinated. And it's very much an activist community kind of organizing system that goes on for prevention. It also, I mean, it is a communist country. They can require you to do things that, you know, maybe we would have to persuade people to do. It was, for instance, there, the loss of life and so on with hurricanes is very low because they have drills. They have hurricane drills where everybody goes, you know, when there's a warning, everybody's evacuated. And I said, you know, well, what if they don't want to go? Well, you know, they'll go. Yeah, and, you know, so I pressed him on it. He said, well, you know, the police would eventually just take them. Including people in nursing homes and that sort of thing. They have a system of maternal hospitals. They believe in hospital births, and that helps to keep their maternal and infant mortality rates down. For women who are at risk, and those are residential places where women who are at risk in their pregnancies go. And I said, what if they don't want to go? They'll go. And I don't know whether that's it's family pressure, community pressure, or what. But the citizens seem to feel that they also have a duty to be healthy, to use these benefits provided free from the state in the service of the state. I didn't get time to tell you about medical tourism and and the export of doctors or pharmaceuticals, which they are actively engaged in, because the embargo doesn't let them buy U.S. pharmaceuticals or medical devices, so they've begun to develop their own.
Thank you very much, Professor Farrow. Well, we have a few minutes left. Hopefully we can hold our speakers here for about 6 more minutes. If there are any questions, we can take them now.
I have a question for Professor Farrow. What's the reimbursement like for the physician?
You won't believe that, but I'll tell you.
Okay.
They get $35 a month. And that's
are they considered elite? Like, is $35 a month then comparable to
$30,000 a year? The average wage, you know, for unskilled labor and that's is about 30. So that's the differential. They go into it because it would seem they really want to. They really want to practice medicine, and you have at least the ones we feel, and see this sort of their patriotic duty to do that, and to under the communist ideology to, you know, provide services to them.
I'm struck. I'm embarrassed. I just lean over to one of my students, and of course, you know, I am Canadian. And grew up with the Canadian health system. I'm also American, but to listen to you with the statistics that you quoted, as far as maternal and child care and mortality, and the other numbers. I mean, it's just, and that in that country, their constitution has health care as a human right. Ours is, you know, one of the two countries that doesn't. And it not far be it for me to say we should be coming soon.
It is interesting to think about whether it can be a model for other countries to follow. And I really think that all depends on the culture of the country that we're talking about following this model and the economics of that country. I was in Liberia, and they are trying to adopt something like the Cuban system. But they don't have hospitals. They don't have clinics. I mean, you know, they just can't, just mirror this model. So there are certainly some things we can learn from the way they do things. But I don't think it's really transferable.
The other thing is, you're right. In African countries, of course, you know, the influx of foreign assistance, so that also distorts things, which you don't have as much, obviously, going to Cuba. So there are many alternatives. So you know, they are obviously, as you pointed out, developing some self-sufficiency. They have to. In Liberia, which is foreign assistance programs like Cuba and CEFA, well, the way that money flows probably doesn't lend itself entirely. But you know, obviously, there's always some solutions.
Yeah.
Why?
Two points one on Cuba, the HIV numbers, don't they, am I making this up, don't they isolate people, don't they?
They did, and that's what I say. I mean, this is an authoritarian...
So if you pull back the curtain a little bit, some of this
Yes and no. They did do it initially when AIDS was first discovered, and nobody really knew how it was communicated. They did mandatorily confine people to sanitaries. Then when they found out how it was transmitted...
They don't do it anymore.
They don't. It's voluntary. They kept those sanitariums open. We visited some. They were quite adequate and good living conditions. So a lot of people just decided to stay there.
And another question I have is, do you have to look at the population to some extent, too? You said their population is how much?
11 million.
Yeah.
And you
said,
yes, that's
okay, and the U.S. population is, what, 300 million? I mean, is there something to be said for it's a little bit easier to manage the health care of something that's 30 times less?
I think that's absolutely right. That's what I mean. It is a transferable model, necessarily, with a much greater population and less cultural differences where the emphasis in our culture is on individualism and their whole culture and their ideology is on the community. You know, so there, and that plays out in important ways. So we shouldn't imagine that.
And the other thing, you're right, remember we have an employer-based healthcare system. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's obviously for better or for worse, that's how it grew up, which radically changes the dynamics. Again, for better or for worse. That's
In a sense, they do too, but the only employer is the state.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's very true.
As far as we know, that it takes a lot of efforts for the international community to dissolve the international disparities. So from your perspective, especially for Mr. Lee, that what kind of deficiencies we have under the existing framework in terms of cooperation?
Well, first off, it's obviously different in every part of the world. In Africa, which is the region of the world with which I'm most familiar, you have certain healthcare challenges which are absolutely dominant, minor being not predicted. An African child dies every 30 seconds from whatever. Stunning, a stunning cost. And so the world community, as enunciated by the UN Secretary General, has decided to take on these goals of universal coverage of Africa with bed nets by end of 2010 this year, elimination of malaria death by 2015. So a huge part of our focus flows through that dynamic. And it's a very different dynamic than you have, obviously, in Latin America and the Caribbean Basin, where there is some malaria, but it's a very, very different sort of thing. So when you analyze global health challenges, you really have to think about it with where, you know, which part of the world you're talking about. But, you know, our first speaker talked about some of the challenges that are out there. We're living in an amazing time of discovery. It's quite remarkable. In the area of malaria, we're seeing incredible progress using the common intervention, which are bed nets, largely. But we're also seeing vaccine trials that largely Gates funded. The Malaria Medicines Vaccine Institute that are very promising, and we're all very, very hopeful, but how you move from those trials to distribution and availability, making it, protecting the intellectual property, in part protecting the integrity of medicine, but yet making sure that you have access and availability to those who could never afford it. Just, you know, in Tanzania where you've got the per capita income $300, there's no possible way you can afford the full price of these medicines. So, those are all challenges that we have to deal with. As I said, I think it's a time of amazing promise because we're talking about taking on challenges that, I mean, just 10 years ago weren't even being discussed. We couldn't. We didn't have the technology. Now the questions are, distribution, taking down the disparities, taking down all the logistics, how you protect against fraud, how you get utilization information out there. You know, we see, which is an educational challenge, which, you know, a country like Cuba has some advantages there. In many parts of Africa, even though we know that bed nets, treated bed nets are a perfect way to take on malaria, you still go into small homes in rural areas and you see the bed nets on the floor next to the door and you say, well, why aren't the bed nets up? And they say, well, they're too valuable, we wouldn't sleep on them. So wait a minute, that's why they exist. Or they'll say, I don't like sleeping on their bed net. It feels like a burial shroud is one that we often get. Or, you know, why would I do that? You know, what's that got to do with malaria? It's mosquito, the parasites of mosquitoes. But so it's an education effort. So all of those are challenges. So you've got resource challenges, you've got technology challenges, and you've got utilization challenges. You've got to have the educational effort that goes out there that teaches young women before they become mothers about preventative care and the steps that they can take. All of those challenges are really key if we're really going to get where I think we all want to get to. So unfortunately, there's no simple answer or silver bullet here. It's really a comprehensive effort.
Thank you. Well, on behalf of all the health law programs, Washington College of Law, thank you for your time and sharing a snapshot of your expertise. It's been enlightening, and again, I just want to invite everyone to thank them one more time for their